My name is Vida McNeil Ajamu. I am 52 years old. Today's date is March 5th, 2020. Location, Memphis, Tennessee. I am here with Josh Spickler. Josh is a community partner and friend.
Yes. Hi. My name is Josh Spickler. I am 45 years old, and it is March 5th, 2020. We're at the National Civil Rights Museum in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm here with my friend and ally, Vida, to talk about our experiences.
So, Josh, let's just go back a little bit. Uh-huh. Tell me just, you know, a little about yourself. Where were you born, Josh?
I was born in Nashville, Tennessee. The first child of two, what would be two children in, the mid-70s during the Ford administration, which is funny. My children don't have any idea that I'm that old. And I grew up there in Middle Tennessee. My father and mother met there because of my dad's military service, and my mom was born and raised there. I came to Memphis for the first time to go to college when I was 18, and I haven't left. So I've been in Memphis for longer than I've been anywhere else in my life, but my family still lives in Nashville, and I love it here, though. I'll never go back.
Well, I'm glad you're here, Josh.
What about you?
You're doing great things.
Thank you.
Here. So, Josh, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. However, I was raised in Olive Branch, Mississippi until I was 16 years old. I was indeed raised by a village. I was raised by my grandmother, my mother, my aunts, and my uncles. My mother was 16 years old when she became pregnant with me.
Oh.
Yeah, she was an honor student. And that was a time, that was the late 60s, and that was a time when the community shunned and shamed teenage mothers and unwed mm-hmm. mothers. So my family rallied behind my mother and supported her and made sure that I learned about, one, inclusion, and two, to work really hard.
Yeah, you know, my mom was 15 and my dad was 20 when they got married. Mm-hmm. They waited 8 years to have me, but they experienced a lot of difficulty. You know, she was 15,
yes,
which I can't
yes.
imagine. And my dad was already in the military and went away to Vietnam not long after they got married. So she was a junior in high school with a husband
mm-hmm.
who was overseas
wow.
fighting in Vietnam. And they had to get special permission to get married. They also had trouble with things like getting my dad a ticket to sit on the field at her graduation, at her high school graduation.
Wow.
So it was a very strange experience for her, but in a different way probably than your mom's. But
yeah.
a very, very young wedding for my
yeah.
family.
That's pretty neat there. Well, my mother, actually, she was put out of the school that she was
wow.
in. That's how bad it was.
Was the school still segregated at that time?
It was. Mm-hmm. And but she was able to go to another school, and she graduated number two in her class.
Wow.
So I have to make sure that I
of
say
course.
That. And so she did great things after that. So that was just a wonderful memory and something that I hold on to in terms of obstacles and challenges and
mm-hmm.
never giving up.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, Josh, what are you passionate about?
Oh, I think you maybe, am passionate about justice, about fairness,
mm-hmm.
about attacking systems that make those things more difficult for people. I've always been a big fan of the underdog.
Mm-hmm.
I have this story in my family. My sister laughs at me about it because it's sort of a famous, you know, you have those family stories
yeah.
that everyone knows and tells over and over again. Well,
yeah.
There's this story about a time when my parents were pulling into the garage. We were coming home from church or something, and we didn't have a garage door opener. We lived way out in the country, and the house was it's not a fancy house, but so I was the garage door opener. So I had to get out of the car when we would get home and open the garage door. And I did one night, and there was a frog that had hopped in behind me as I opened the door, and it was in the way of the car. And I couldn't signal my father fast enough to stop, and he ran over the frog. And just it was horrific. I can remember it to this day. I can remember the feeling of like that frog not having a chance. And I don't know what it is about that story. I mean, I lived in the country and animals, you know, live and die, and you experience all that when you live out in the country. But something about that frog on that garage floor that I have never forgotten. And it is just a really clear to me in my brain an image of so many of the things that I've experienced as an attorney and as an advocate now with this system. It's just the overwhelming force of something that you seemingly can't stop, and right. and it can just squish. Mm-hmm. And we have so many systems like this. This museum and your work at the Civil Rights Museum is such a testament and tells that story so well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. So I'm not saying that frog inspired me by any right. means, but I just, when I think about my experience and why I am passionate about the work that I do and why I do so badly want to even the playing field for people, it's there's just something about people that don't get the same opportunity as everyone else, or as me particularly, that I just cannot stand by. And I'm so happy that whatever has happened in my experience has led me to this, because I'm fulfilled by it. I'm exhausted by it. I'm yes. frustrated by it, but I love doing it every day. And so that's kind of something inside me drives me to want to do this. And I'm so happy that I've found the advocacy work that I do, which maybe we can talk more about. But you're on staff at the National Civil Rights Museum. What drives you? What are you passionate about here at this work and in your life?
Well, you know, so I'm going to go back just a little bit and thinking about how you talked about your childhood and what inspired you. So I talked a little bit about being raised by a village and being raised in Olive Branch, Mississippi, until I was 16. So, and coming here to Memphis is where I came. Mm-hmm. It was very different from me. In Mississippi, the school I went to, it was both black and white together, going to school together. When I came to Memphis, I moved into an inner city school, and the entire student body was black at Melrose High School. So it was actually a shift for me. So I had a chance to experience what it felt like to be in an environment where there were black and white children at one school. However, although we were in Olive Branch High School, we still had separate Mr. and Ms. Senior or whatever grade
by
level
race,
you was.
Separated by
right.
Race. Wow.
You know, when it came for the competitions like Homecoming Queen or Mr. and Ms. Football, Mr. and Ms. Senior, those things. So it was a black set. And
wow.
it was a white set.
Wow.
And I remember winning Miss Class Freshman Beauty. And that was a white set and a black set. And then so to transition, that was really weird. And that, I don't even know if that's still going on there. But to come to Memphis and just find that pride, or African-American pride, everybody together and feeling the same. You know, it's when I got a chance to see and understand that equity piece.
Right. You noticed the difference between the schools and the quality of the education?
Absolutely. I noticed the difference in the schools. I noticed it in so many, in various ways, whether it was the textbooks or the way that we were being taught or the additional programming that we had, the opportunities that we had, the field trips, all of that was very different.
Mm-hmm.
All of that was very different. So, you know, to fast forward as time passed by, that's something that always stuck with me because, as I stated, inclusion was a big thing in my family. So whether it was about people with disability or whatever, mm-hmm. so I thought about equity, I thought about inclusion, so all these different things because of my obstacles. So fast forward here to be at the National Civil Rights Museum, it's like the perfect place to be to better understand my history and to really try to move the needle forward, making sure I do my part, basically, is what I'm saying. So in everything that I do, I think about all these different things. I think about the civil rights movement. I'm passionate about the civil and human rights. I'm passionate about criminal justice reform, mm-hmm. especially mandatory minimum sentencing.
Right.
So all these different things, there's so much that I'm passionate about, and I can't do something about everything, but I know I can do something about some things. And so being here allows me to do exactly that.
You talked about the pride that you felt at Melrose when you were going, when you transferred and it was an all black school.
Yes.
And maybe, can you say more about, I have no gauge for that. I have no reference for that as a white man who's 45 years old. What is it like to, what did that mean to you as a teenager? And what does it mean to you now? And what it, explain that.
Okay, so let me first be honest in saying when I first arrived there, I didn't know that that's what the school was going to, that was what it was going to be like. And I was afraid because I had never been in an environment like that. Mm-hmm. I had grown up, you know, differently. So from Mississippi to Tennessee, so it's the city, from country to the city. In Mississippi, I was working in the garden and doing things like uh-huh. that. And now I'm in the city. But going into the school, the environment was so different. But then I saw how the teachers took the time to say, this is where you are. Let's work on getting here. So it was more of the teachers treating me like I'm their child.
This is or their niece. In the new school.
In the Melrose, new school. Yeah. So at Melrose. So that's what it was important for the African American teachers at Melrose to make sure that the African American students succeed.
Yeah.
And I don't remember feeling that. I can't say that I felt mistreated, per se, in Olive Branch, but I never felt the type of love and care from a teacher, a white teacher, like what I felt from the teachers at Melrose.
Right. Right. I think about my I mean, I went to an all-white school way out in the country. It was a small Christian school, and I didn't go to school with African Americans until college, and even then I went to a pretty white college. I have nothing to compare that to, and I wonder, the work of the Civil Rights Museum mm-hmm. is important to what. So, but what's the dream? What's the mission? How should we as Americans understand that experience more? I mean, because what you're describing is not something bad. It's not a negative memory.
No.
And yet, I mean, the disparities and the challenges that face this country around race, issues of race, have to me never been starker, have never been more clear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are we missing? I mean, I'm asking you to solve racism, but
right. You know, I just think that what we are missing is treating people like people. You know, Josh, you know, you and I, the work that we're doing together and just beginning to talk. I really don't know how our paths would have crossed for us to have a conversation if it wasn't my involvement in criminal justice, mm-hmm. my, you know, being directly impacted, mm-hmm. but having more conversations,
mm-hmm.
not ignoring each other.
Right.
But it's a huge problem.
Yeah.
And no kids should feel a different way when they go to a certain school.
No, and no kid should not know that there's another kid out there having a totally different experience, right?
Right.
I mean, I'm 45 and I'm having conversations like this
mm-hmm.
For the first time. You mm-hmm. know, I guess academically, probably when I was a kid, I knew that, you know, there was structural mm-hmm. problems and that racism was a mm-hmm. thing. I mean, family would say things that I verified to
right.
me that there's racism, but I think, you know, the kids who are like me who have opportunity, you know, shoveled upon them,
yeah.
don't have these conversations either, right? And they don't understand that for having conversations, for having relationships, for having better understanding of each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, the older I get, and reflecting on that and just talking about that with you, it's a reminder even of how it was for my mom, you know, for my grandmother, that taking the best of what they had while they didn't have the newest books uh-huh. at Melrose, and the best of everything in all these programs. They did the best they could with what they had. And that's so much of what happened with our ancestors, that they took what they had and mm-hmm. made the best of it. And but it should be, you know, we should work towards making sure everybody has the same thing. But it's mm-hmm. just a reminder that we have come so far, mm-hmm. but we still have so far to go.
So far. Let's talk about your brother.
Okay.
You mentioned him a minute ago, and you mentioned you're passionate about working against mandatory minimums.
Yeah.
Let's dive into why.
Yeah. So my brother, Robert, this is really strange how I got involved in the criminal justice system. I knew nothing about it. My brother he's my paternal brother, and I got this call from my dad screaming, begging me to help my brother. You know, you got to help him. If anybody can, you can. And they won't let him go. And when he shared that with me, and he told me that they'd given him life. At the time, he was 20. And I have to be honest, I didn't know anything about the criminal justice system, nor did I know anything about my brother's case. My father, as I stated, my mother was unwed. My father moved away. He was older. He was 3 years older than my mother. He moved away with his family to Chicago. I grew up down south, and they grew up north. And so I didn't get to see him a whole lot. And to be quite honest, I felt a little salty that he was calling me, crying about about my brother. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, my dad is on the phone and what he's screaming about. But it was a cry of hurt, a cry of pain, a cry that, like you mentioned about that frog, that how you remember feeling that, mm-hmm. it comes up in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lump in my throat when I think about, I can still hear the sound, because after the words came a moan and then a groan, and I knew I had to do something.
Yeah.
So I got busy in finding out about the laws, and I was thinking surely he had to have done something more than, you know, selling drugs, a nonviolent crime. It was a conspiracy. Then to get a life sentence, surely, right? But after I started digging and looking, and then I learned about the mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines, and I saw how unfair
right.
and how unjust. And I learned his case backwards and forward, and I set out to fight for freedom and justice for him. I'm so glad I did.
Yeah.
He and I became super, super close. We call each other twin. he graduated number two in his class. And he should have been going to college instead of going to prison. And the piece about that, Josh, the sad part is people don't understand the backstory, and they don't care about the backstory. What's going on? What took a person to that point?
Right.
How did they get involved? How did an understudent get involved with a group of people selling drugs? You know,
right?
Again, we're going to talk about inequity. We're going to talk about the neighborhood that he lived in, where there was crime on outside of, you know, every door, every corner, all these things that our children are faced with that people are not talking about.
Right.
Even if they're shipped out to a different school, they still have to come back to their neighborhood. They're in their neighborhoods when they're out for the breaks. They're in the neighborhoods on the weekend. They're in the neighborhoods after school. And they're still in these same environments no matter what. But one of my brother, I'm the oldest, and my brother under me, he was murdered when my brother Robert was 16 years old. That literally sent him on the tailspin. And some guys in the neighborhood said, your brother, we'll take care of you. You know, we'll take care
right.
of you. And that's how he
that
got involved
beginning.
With that. So I'm grateful that I fought for him.
Yeah.
And so, good news?
Yeah, please.
So, right.
Tell us the good news.
Yeah, so his life sentence was reduced to 30 years mm-hmm. after amendment, all drugs minus two, amendment to the law,
mm-hmm.
and after serving 25 years, 10 months, and 12 days, he's now a free man.
Yeah, that is.
And so he's doing great things. He's doing things to better his community. He had to go back to Chicago. That's where his mother is. That's where his daughter, who was 2 years old. I keep saying two, right? But his daughter was 2 years old when he went to prison. And so he's there with his grandchildren and trying to rebuild a life with his daughter because she's so angry about him leaving her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another part of this mass incarceration, mm-hmm. the generational problems that it creates.
Right.
Not to say that he shouldn't have been punished, but given a life sentence for 5 months involvement in a nonviolent drug conspiracy was just out of this world. So, but he's doing great things. So he's working, doing consulting work with an organization by the name of Cure Violence. And so he's traveling and talking to people about, you know, nonviolence and all these different things. And then he and I made a vow that we would continue to fight for criminal justice reform together. So he and I have been traveling as well. And in fact, he will be here in March.
In Memphis.
In Memphis. Event that we are partnering
on. Yeah, that's right. I can't wait to meet him.
Yeah.
I was talking about this yesterday with some college students about the thing you said about the kids in the neighborhoods, and I don't know if I said it or if one of the students said it, but we react only in the criminal legal system to the crime.
Mm-hmm.
We don't react to the person.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, this is what happens, right? You send a young man away for 30 years of his life without really understanding what that means or why or what we're trying to accomplish. We don't want drugs in our communities.
Right, absolutely.
But we only respond to someone having drugs in our community. We don't respond to why that person might have had drugs in our community or anything else about that person.
Mm-hmm.
And we just keep hearing this story over and over and over again of people like Robert, like your brother, who were robbed of more than half his life, but.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, less than half of his life. Hopefully, he lives a long time and has other experiences. But it's essential that we begin to see people and not crime.
Absolutely.
Like you said, people have to face accountability for doing things that are harmful or not legal.
Yeah.
But if we, as you said it already, is, you know, see people as people. And this system is the absolute worst at it.
Yes.
I can't think of another system, a modern system that fails so miserably at that. And I'm just so happy when I hear stories like Robert's and meet people like you who have forced the system to see the person. Right? I mean, that's what you did. You basically just pried the eyes of the system open.
Right.
And said, look at this man, look at this unfairness, and fix it. And they did.
Absolutely. So my father, in 2012, my father, he died unexpectedly. But I received a call. I woke up to a call from my brothers. My phone, as soon as I turned my phone on, it ding, 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 ding. And I answered, I checked my voicemails, and each other brother left me a voicemail saying, you need to get here now. Mind you, I'm in Memphis, and my father's in Chicago. So they tell me that they had revived him 3 times already. So, of course, the first thing I do is get a flight out, and I get there for my father. But I was thinking about my brother Robert. How could I tell him what was going on with our father? But when I got there, my father was so restless, so restless. And he was fighting, trying to get out of the bed, and they had tied his hands. And everything that I said to my father, nothing comforted him. Nothing at all comforted him. And I thought, when I told him I loved him, he just, nothing comforted him. But when I said the words to him that I would never stop fighting for Bus, which is my brother, that was the only thing that calmed him.
Wow.
And tears rolled down his eyes. A few hours later, he died.
Mm-hmm.
And the system doesn't know or care what it does to families.
Right. And you've said this to me before about the family serving the time just as much as the person, if not more sometimes. Yeah.
It's really hard. It is. And I use a hashtag all the time, family serve time too.
Yeah.
It's difficult. And it's, again, it's creating a cycle. You're taking mothers and fathers away from their children. They're struggling. It's difficult. I'm happy the story turned out that my brother is home. My mother wasn't his mother, but she was my biggest cheerleader and his cheerleader. And she was the last person. He was the last person she talked to before she passed.
Oh, when was that?
She passed in 2012, April of lung cancer.
Awesome.
And she did get a chance to go visit him about 6 months prior to. She begged her doctor to let her go. And at the time, he was in Greenville, Illinois. And so the doctor said, only if you drive, if they drive and you have to stop every hour and take a 15 or 20 minute break.
Mm-hmm.
And so that trip turned into this super long trip, but we made it and she got to see him. But when she passed, well, right before she passed, she had really stopped responding. But when he called, she talked to him. She said to him, I won't see you on this side, but make me proud.
Yeah.
And he cried. And she cried. Well, we cried. And but that type of love, and these are, I don't know, people think that if you have a loved one that's in prison, that the family is bad, or they came from a bad family, or, you know, they didn't raise their children well. They don't think about all the other, you know, other things that come into play. And another thing we need to do is get rid of the stigma. For a long time, I didn't talk about my brother being incarcerated because of the stigma. And still now, people think, if you got, as I stated, if you have a loved one in prison, that, you know, what's wrong with your family?
What happened?
What's wrong with your mother, your father, or whatever? But that's not the case. So I when my father passed, I made a decision that the world was going to know about the injustice they had done to my brother. They may not remember my name, but I was going to make sure that they knew his name and knew his case. And I got busy.
You did. What was it like? I don't think I've ever been able to ask you this question. What was it like when you first saw Robert on the outside? Tell us about that moment.
Wow. So he had to go to the halfway house first. And so I went to the halfway house to see him and to just see him without khakis, in his clothes. It was so funny. He had earbuds in his ears. He had a phone, right? And so he's learning how to use this phone, and he's got the earbuds in. And then when his phone would ring, he holding the phone up, but the earbuds in. So it was just so funny. But when I saw him, we just embraced, and it was a feeling of relief for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
We were both very emotional because we knew that it was over.
Yeah.
This was the end of it. So I have been there several times. I have stayed. Every time I go to Chicago, I stay with him. This will be his first time coming down here. And just to have him in my home, just to have him, I can't even describe it. It's like, my first time, I was touching on him like
just to make sure.
And then he was coming into my room, and I was going into his room. We were like kids. It was like, I don't know. It was the craziest thing, but
that's so great.
People just see the love when they see us together. And when we went to D.C. together, and other people, it was like, oh, my goodness. You know, they say we look just alike, but they say that love, that the love that they see that we have for each other, the bond.
Yeah.
And that's something, too, that I want to encourage other family members to do, and that's what I do, mm-hmm. encourage them not to give up on their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
My brother used to say that I was his lifeline, but he had become mine as well.
Wow. It worked both ways.
It worked both ways.
That's crazy. I can remember, there's been a few clients, and we haven't said this, but I'm an attorney. There have been a few clients in my experience that I have gotten really close to during the case, and like fought really hard for. And I can feel the hug still.
Yeah.
Like there's something about some of those hugs I think the one you're describing, yeah. the embrace, that I can still feel. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the same feelings, totally different experience. You yeah. know, these are not my relatives, but right. just the relief mm-hmm. and the sense of finality, like yeah. this is done. There's more to do, but mm-hmm. this thing is done. Mm-hmm. And that's really strong. What? Let's talk about the National Civil Rights Museum.
So, you know, at the National Civil Rights Museum, I have been at the museum since 2010. I came to the museum as executive assistant to the president, to the past president. So I have served as executive assistant to two presidents.
Uh-huh.
What a huge responsibility.
Sure.
Yeah, it is. Executive assistants are not given as much credit as they should be given, of course,
no.
Because they truly, truly, it's not just an admin position. It's truly a job where you have to be able to do a lot
mm-hmm.
and have a lot of input and a lot of say-so into things. And it's been so rewarding because I've learned so much. I learned so much from the past president, Beverly Robertson, and I've learned so much from Terry Lee Freeman, the current president. They have two different styles of leadership, but it allowed me to see that I could be a leader in various ways.
Right.
A couple of years ago, I was promoted into a position of manager of community outreach, and that's so rewarding because I'm able to do my advocacy and this work at the same time. It pairs really right. well. I'm able to talk about the civil and human rights that I'm passionate about, as well as the criminal justice stuff.
What do you think this National Civil Rights Museum's greatest impact on this community and this country has been?
Wow, I think the impact. This space and this place is so special. Again, it shows, it provides the history of the past, and it shows how far we've come, but yet it reminds you of how far we have to go. But what's different about this place and how it has an impact, it talks about the past, but it also pairs it with what's going on today. So the issues with poverty, mm-hmm. the issues with economic justice, racial justice, all of these different things that we talked about then, we're still talking yeah. about now. So we can use current events, current issues, current social problems, mm-hmm. and compare them to what happened right. then. And it's sad to say that these things are still going on, but the museum has a way of telling the story.
Mm. And that the story is not over.
And the story is not over, that the struggle is real, it's still true, it still exists, but we have the opportunity to make a difference.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We can move the needle forward. And, you know, if we just we have to do our part. It's going to take all of us to do something. And that's why we have to keep talking about it.
I think my favorite part about the museum, not like a particular thing about the museum, but is the place, is the ground that it sits on. And I know there have been criticisms about turning the hotel into the museum and mm-hmm. charging admission and all those things. But I think the most powerful experiences I've had at this museum and vicinity have been about recognizing what the ground represents.
Absolutely.
And the event that happened here. And I obviously will never, ever forget the time that you had us on a tour. We had someone in town, and you swung the door to the hotel room open mm-hmm. sort of unexpectedly
right.
to the balcony. Mm-hmm. And the two people that I was with burst into tears immediately. I waited till I got in my car. Mm-hmm. But I will never forget the power of stepping out onto that balcony and remembering what happened here. And I mean, I don't think there's not a spot on the planet that could better capture the importance of Dr. King's work and the importance of continuing that work and honoring it and having a place to come and learn. And it's a really incredible place. You're really lucky to get to work here.
Yeah, I am. And in fact, when I am discouraged or I'm feeling that I've hit a block or a challenge or an obstacle, or even when I would be tired of fighting for something, some type of justice, it's two places in this museum that I come to get a boost, to be reminded of how far I've come, to be reminded of what Dr. King did for us. And one is going on the balcony.
Yeah.
And I'm reminded, even if I don't go on the balcony, I'll go up to the room or I go outside and take a look at it. And I reflect about how tired he was, but he still fought for us. So I don't get to be tired. You know, he was frustrated too, but he didn't stop. So I can't be tired.
Yeah.
And the other space that I go to is the area where it talks about Ole Miss, where I went to college.
Oh.
And once upon a time, black people could not go to Ole Miss. And I'm a fourth generation Ole Miss alumni. You know, so even that, even my aunts that went to Ole Miss and my going to Ole Miss, it wasn't the best experience going to Ole Miss, but yet I withstood mm-hmm. whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm grateful for that opportunity.
This is off script, Vita.
Mm-hmm.
What? I'm a 45-year-old white man, mm-hmm. and I get to do really important work, and sometimes I win and sometimes I lose, and sometimes I get to have conversations like this, and I get invited into spaces that I don't deserve to be in, which, frankly, this is one of them. What do 45-year-old white men need to be doing to help heal mm-hmm. the country, to help heal the wounds of racism and slavery and civil rights abuses? And is that a fair question?
I think it's a fair question, Josh, and I think that you're doing absolutely that. And the work that you do, when you talk about the work that you do with that, I know that you're out there and you're fighting for rights for African American. You see those black boys that are going to prison for something that a white boy wouldn't go to prison for. And then you're out there, you're bailing them out. You're creating programs to help. And so I think, for me, honesty is the best thing. And having those conversations, just saying that to me like that and us talking about it, that dialogue, to say, you know what, Vita, I don't understand that. You know, I didn't experience that. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Yeah.
And how do you suggest that I do that? And I should do the same with you to better understand why you think like you think. So I just think that you should do what you can. But there again, it goes back to communication.
Listening.
To see what the need is. I always say I heard someone say it and I've repeated it, is those that's closest to the problem are closest to the solution. So talk to the people that are impacted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you're very kind to say those things about me, Vita. I was not fishing for a compliment, but I really appreciate it. I think what I heard you say is that 45-year-old white men need to listen. And I think we do a terrible job at listening, just generally. Some of us are trying harder than others, but most of us don't listen when we should.
Well, I think that, Josh, you definitely listen. And I just think that we should listen to each other.
I agree.
Yeah.